This is Vandana Shiva, and you're listening to the Enviro Show. Remember, listen to your mother. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
Greetings, Earthlings. It's another Arbor Day Enviro Show. I am one of your co-hosts, Dio, and I'm not in the studio with...
Happy Arbor Day. This is Glenn Ayers.
Yes, Glenn. Hey, we had a lot of Earth Day events recently. So many, in fact, that a lot of folks are using the term Earth Week. Why stop there? This Earth Month is out there, too. A reminder, Arbor Day is upon us. Yes, a special day focused just on trees, and you know... We're all about this on this show, or I should say we're all about that on this show. And with that in mind, we have a special announcement. Yours truly's new collection of poetry and prose titled It's the Trees is launching today, Arbor Day. More on that later. All right. I think it's time for our Enviro Show Quote of the Week. And Glenn, this one may be a repeat. Quote, deep down at the molecular heart of life, the trees and we are essentially identical. Close quote. And that was Carl Sagan.
Yeah. Well, can't argue with that.
No, but that does bring us to our interview. Who are we interviewing this week?
Yeah, for this show, this is a kind of a special show, and I feel like after doing the Enviro Show for pretty much 20 years now, we've earned a license to be self-indulgent. So I think that's what we could really call this show, is a self-indulgent show about trees and about praising trees. And I guess this is sort of our equivalent of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. But today we're going to be talking about the leaves of trees, and metaphorically, I guess, but also, you know, how the book itself is made up of pages, which are sort of like leaves, if you think of it that way.
The recycled leaves.
And recycled, yeah. I mean, the books are made out of trees, pretty much. So just the whole thing, you have to think about it. Anyway, so today on the Enviro Show, we're not interviewing ourselves, but I'm essentially interviewing you, and we're going to be talking about this new grouping of writing, poems, and all about trees, and I'll let you introduce this book. You can tell us how long you've worked on it, what the inspiration was for putting the pen to the paper. And then we can have some dramatic readings of some of the materials that are being published on Arbor Day in praise of trees. Start off with a piece that sets the theme, and then we'll get into the inspiration and the process.
Okay, I'll read directly from the introduction. So I discovered many years ago that my family name was derived from an old Saxon name, Oakton, and rough translation being people from the Vale of the Oaks. And that stuck with me over the years, and even more so since I became active in the movement to protect and preserve trees and forests in this age of climate crisis. The oak was a highly revered tree in ancient times and in what is now Western Europe, for its beauty and strength and being home to mistletoe, which seemed to magically grow without roots in the upper branches. So we are told that the Druids identified especially with the oaks and its seeming magical properties. So that's just the beginning of the introduction. I have to say that I've been writing in terms of both prose and poetry about trees for the past bunch of years. I mean, we've been talking about it on the show seemingly forever. Like Glenn said, it'll be 20 years in this coming August. And I just started compiling them. Listeners may recall my previous book, bad atmosphere, a collection of poetry and prose on the climate crisis. And that was back in the, maybe late 90s. I can't even recall anymore. So I was just thinking too much time has passed since I had done it again. So I started putting this together, and my friends at Levelers Press down at Collective Copies in both Amherst and Florence, I talked to them about it, and Stevie Strymer, my editor, thought it was time as well. And they're vacating their Amherst property and moving over everything over to Florence. So he thought that this would be kind of a swan song for the Amherst Collective Copies office. And it may be a swan song for yours truly. I don't know. I turn 80 next month. I don't know how much time I have. In any case, that's the sort of the background behind all this. And I've gotten some great blurbs promoting the book on the back cover. And Glenn's significant other, Mary, is the artist who did the cover.
I want to ask you, first off, you know, you've spent a lot of times essentially living in the woods. Where you live, you're surrounded by forest.
White pine.
And I mean, you kind of have a homestead surrounded by forest. Right behind you to the north is Diamond Match Ridge, which was, you know, a source of wood for the making of all kinds of wood things, like matches, for instance, and other things. Remember, matches used to be made out of little sticks of wood with, you know, kind of the match head on it. But they were also, I remember when I was young, they were in actual wooden boxes, little wooden boxes full of wooden matches. And, you know, that was the Diamond Match Company. And that ridge extends up into toward Irving or Wendell in that direction. And it's a big kind of wild area back there. At one time, it had been completely logged, and now it is growing back and rewilding, and parts of that are in the Wendell State Forest.
Right.
And so, you know, so that's your backyard, and, you know, the forest kind of surrounds your existence. And yet we have talked about on this show a lot, kind of the fact that we just take forests for granted, and we don't understand, we're not in relation really with the natural world so much as we're in the consumption mode of consuming forests. And that's one thing that we've talked about a lot on this show, is having a different relationship and understanding that without forests, we really don't have a stable climate. We don't have a stable way to exist. And yet, especially here in North America, we have wiped out more than 95% of the original forests that existed when the native people had been living here for thousands, tens of thousands of years, and yet the European invasion arrived, and within a couple of hundred years, most of the forests were wiped out. Most of the original forest, as the Europeans referred to it, the howling wilderness, was wiped out, you know, and then we went through this whole thing of sheep fever and all that, until the forest was abandoned, or the land was abandoned, and the forests have now regrown. So the forests that we have around us are second or third or fourth generation regrowing forests. And so that's kind of the setting that you have where you live. And I think that that's kind of the inspiration for many of us, is that we're watching the forest recover and rewild. And we want to see that process continue, because many species that were completely gone from New England are slowly, very slowly returning. And we've seen that over the last 20 years since this show has been on, that we do occasionally have moose that come in to this area, and fisher cats, things that were gone, and they're making a comeback. And that's because the forest is their home, and something that we don't really think about, how we live in our own individual boxes, and we rarely, for the most part, we rarely exist in nature, even though it surrounds us. So anyway, I'd like you to read an actual piece from the book that has to do with the relationship that we have with nature and with forests, and identifying the fact that the forests are really the key thing to our existence in this region and really globally.
Well, there's a lot to choose from, but I start the book with a short poem called Before, which harkens back to what you were talking about just a little while ago, about the primeval forest and what came before us. So, before us, the before, waiting in the forest floor, mist there and fallen oak, sun hidden below and living forms slowly moving in the past in shadow, times ancient and the signs, the days marked among the stones, the search, struggle for some comfort, for family, for homes, and fire, of course, and its keepers, familiars, dwellings so much deeper among us. So that's how the book starts out after the introduction. And then here's when you started talking about the forest up behind us here, that it goes into Wendell State Forest and what used to be Leverett State Forest. When we were working with Wendell State Forest Alliance trying to stop the cutting by the Department of Cut and Run, this poem sort of came to me, and it's about the oaks that were cut. So, the oaks. Remember these trees and our verities, wielders of power, recall this hour and those who stood this ground, a century, actions of consequent, moments of reprehense when they fell out of time. Because of this crime, this great oak stand, this bleeding land, shall not be forgotten. Winter is still followed by spring.
Nice. Yeah. I think that that was one of the, I'm going to say, most inspiring forest actions or activities that I've been involved in recently, at least, you know, over the last 20 years or so, was that opposition to the chopping down of a beautiful, intact, mature oak forest in Wendell State Forest and the Brook Road timber sale. And the level of opposition to that and the complete disregard by the state, by the people selling the timber at the state level, and they just did not care at all. And they actually see it as their job to destroy the forest. The mission of the agency, the so-called Department of Conservation and Recreation, DCR, which we say stands for the Department of Cut and Run, because that's what they actually do. But their mission, the DCR's mission right on their website says that their mission, number one mission, is to protect forests. And yet they are the most destructive entity when it comes to public lands that are owned by the people. And they just treat them as their own tree farm to chop down trees whenever they want. And the opposition that we mounted there, that was just very inspirational. And I wish that that kind of opposition would grow and continue and multiply and flourish, and that we could actually effectuate the, I'd say we need to actually eliminate the Department of Cut and Run completely, replace that with the Department of Parks and Biodiversity or something like that. We no longer need this outmoded, decrepit agency that is just full of, really, I'm going to say it, tree-hating foresters. They hate the forest, they hate the land, and they want to chop down as many trees as they possibly can because they get to keep the money. It's just complete self-serving. That's all it is. So anyway, I've gone off on a tangent. I'd like to get back to, let's talk about the poetic aspect of trees. And I think a lot of times we can use poetry as a way to highlight the fact that we do have that part within us that wants to be in harmony and wants to have a deeper appreciation and understanding of the natural world, and especially here in New England, the forests. This would be an entirely forested region if it were not for exploitation and overconsumption. So let's have another couple of poems that bring the spirit of the forest back into harmony with nature.
Okay, but before we get to the spirit of the forest, you focused in on DCR, and that's what this poem addresses as well. There's an F-bomb in here, but other than that, I think it describes pretty much how we both feel about DCR. And this is called Roots and Branches. Roots and branches reaching light and water and your touch. Beneath it all, the street, the wall, and the fall, and the garden. All so much for that, your intentions, apprehensions, and even expanding misunderstanding, alienation from creation, you fucking idiots, and you digits, your calculations, the ruined relations, reaching light and water beneath it all and above, your fall, we await your fate.
Perfect. My sentiments exactly.
So now, moving on to the, as you said, sort of the spirit of trees and the forest. This one is called Leaves. Turning always turning under sun in a breeze, turning light into air, a chemistry, an alchemy, you and me and a tree and confusion. I said, you choose an illusion. You said, nothing I can recall. And then came the fall and all those colors and you were gone. And that actually is for a cousin of mine who took his own life a few years back. But I have one I think that's more apropos for what you had in mind. Here's one that you and Mary, your significant other, might like, given that you're both in the tree committee in Greenfield, planting trees. Forethought and a shovel, some water and a bucket or two, a few others to help and ponder the future and uncertainty, the children and theirs. This is no trade, no excuse to cut a well-grown forest down to the ruined ground. Not an either-or violation, it is something more, another act of giving in a world of taking.
Yeah, that is what we're talking about. Yeah. Well, how about one that takes us back to the place we were talking about? How about reading Every Tree Everywhere All at Once?
Okay. Every Tree Everywhere All at Once, of course, is a takeoff on the film of a similar name. And I wrote it back in June of last year. A message to loggers or others with an axe to grind. Have you thought about being kind to your children or theirs and on, who now depend upon trees capturing carbon dioxide and storing the carbon within themselves and the soil below? Or did you not know about the emergency? We are beginning to see a climate in chaos with a life-threatening heat and rubble of your home at your feet, or water thigh high on your street, or a new plague that many meet, millions and defeat the civilization you need to survive a future so bleak and likely not one you seek.
Yeah.
I gather that one must have spoke to you.
Yes, I like that one. And I also like the prose piece, Think Like a Tree, which I assume is sort of a follow-up to Aldo Leopold's essay about thinking like a mountain. And, you know, in that essay, very famous essay by Aldo Leopold, he talks about how when they were young and trigger-happy from across a valley, they saw a wolf pack, or at least an adult wolf with a bunch of pups. And their immediate reaction was to get their guns and start shooting until basically all the wolves were dead. And then they went down to the valley, I guess, to admire their destruction of the wild wolf, and they reach the wolf in time to watch the fierce green fire in her eyes fade away.
Right.
And that was a triggering kind of moment, no pun intended, for Aldo Leopold, where he realized that what they had done was essentially, instead of thinking like the mountain, they were thinking like a human. And actually the mountain understood that in order to have balance, you had to have predators to keep the deer population in check, or else the deer population would get to the point where they would eat everything, including all the trees and young trees especially, but then their population would crash because they would run out of food. But because the wolves kept the population of deer in check by essentially picking off the weakest and the oldest and any with disease, they kept the deer healthy, but they also kept the balance in the forest. And the mountain appreciated that balance very much, because in order for the soils to remain intact on the steep slopes of the mountain, it needed that tree cover. And if you got rid of the wolves, then you got rid of the check on the deer population, and the deer population ate all the vegetation, and then that made the soil wash away. And so all these connections were part of thinking like a mountain. And what they needed to do instead of thinking like a human was actually to start thinking like the mountain thinks. So anyway, this is a small prose piece that you wrote about thinking like a tree. And if you could read that.
Okay. This is one of the prose pieces in the book. It's probably the shortest one. Yeah, I didn't, you know, I frankly must have had Aldo Leopold in the back of my head, but the phrase think like a tree just came to me, and it was just a few weeks ago, but it came to me in another context, and I can't remember what it was, but it was certainly fitting. So in any case, maybe that will be revealed as I read it. Think like a tree. I've tried for many decades, pretty much in vain, to convince climate activists to look at the issue we are dealing with in a holistic manner. Emissions are only part of the picture. Capturing CO2 and other emissions from burn technologies and naturally storing the carbon is the another part. Why go halfway in advocating for the planet in a climate crisis? Yes, we must stop emissions from the source, but there already are far too many of them in the atmosphere, some of them long-lived. Forests and trees are some of the few natural solutions available to us, and they capture CO2 and other emissions daily, year after year after year, for free. They are some of Earth's most important biotic pumps, creating moisture through transpiration and transporting it into the atmosphere. They interact positively in the soil with fungi and bacteria, even with surrounding trees, either directly or by intertwining their roots, or indirectly by growing fungal networks around the roots, acting as a sort of extended nervous system connecting each other. So why don't most climate action organizations do that?
Yeah, I think that is thinking like a mountain, thinking like a tree. And one of the key things that we fail to incorporate into our worldview is this idea of how do we integrate all of this complexity into an existence that we want to be simple. We want things to be simple and about comfort and convenience and security when we live in an incredibly complex, interdependent world. And how do we translate that relationship with complexity into our daily lives and still maintain some ability to respect the complexity and to interact in complex ways, not in the non-reciprocal, exploitative way that we have been brought up to relate. So anyway, I think that that's kind of the point of a lot of our thinking about forests and not just trees. I mean, big old trees, they're very important, but they're important because they're the grandfathers or the grandmothers of the forest. And we just have not been brought up with that kind of philosophical worldview or underpinning or actual relationship with nature. And it's led to a lot of problems, a lot of problems. And we don't need to go into some of the other poems, you know, speak to that about dominion. And, you know, that's the attitude that's very predominant. It's a very religious, puritanical, almost based relationship of dominion over nature. And yeah, we've talked about that on the show, but you also talk about that in your poems as well. Right. So yeah. Anyway, I think that we need to read a lot more poetry, which helps us, well, enter into a different kind of reality. I want to say I think poetry activates a different part of your brain than we normally use. And that's a part of the brain that we have kind of walled off because of this way that we are, where we have to make things so simple that we can't make decisions, we can't make considerations, because we have to keep things so simple. And that's part of the dominion, obviously, and that's part of the lack of empathy and relation with all beings, you know, kind of the native perspective, the native indigenous culture's perspective on it. When they lived here, it was their home. It was their world. It wasn't a howling wilderness. But the European mindset, which I think, you know, we have now expanded to contaminate the entire North American continent, you know, that's really where things went so far off the track and are still really heading in the wrong direction. Hence the climate emergency and our ecological overshoot with the carrying capacity of the land that we inhabit right now. Anyway.
Sad to say, but when you're talking about that part of your brain, I'm thinking that music must also be affecting that part of our brains. Like, I'm thinking of like Tom Nielsen's song about the Quabbin. I could keep playing that over and over through the years, and because it touches me in some way that, you know, just reading some scientific paper or some news report never would. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's that kind of left brain, right brain, and the bridge between the two. Anyway, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. We have to move on to the end of the show, the bus stop billboard. And I really, you know, this was great to have a kind of a homegrown part of the show that we have not often done. I mean, we do rant and rave a lot, but it's nice to have this native kind of in-house tribute to the trees. So thanks, Dio, for that. And I hope folks will pick up a copy of the book and spend some time with it.
Well, thank you for doing the interview, Glenn. As we move on to the bus stop billboard, I want to start by saying the top of the bus stop billboard is just filled with weekly actions that happen every week at different parts of the valley and around the region. So you want to check that out because, you know, we almost have actions daily about what's been going on, you know, with the government, the national government.
So, well, I'll just say that, as we say on the show, activism is the antidote to despair. And we also say to remember
to listen to your mother.
That's right. So this is Glenn Ayers, and pick up a good book about trees, maybe a book of poetry, and sit down under in the understory of a big tree and melt into the soil and embrace the forest.
That's right. And if you go to the blog, EnviroShow, that's www.blogspot.com, you can click on the link and order your copies from Levelist Press. This is Dio saying adios. Happy Arbor Day.
Hey, happy Arbor Day. Take care, folks.
I am Mother Earth, and I approve of this message.